inspired by the refugees today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Greek island of Lesbos has received thousands of refugees over the past couple of months, and this reporter has seen them come ashore.
I was so moved by these people. You feel every single one is on a sort of epic adventure, and I was awed by the spirit and the bravery of these people.
Also, the trove of Western art in Iran that survived a revolution and 36 years underground thanks to one determined custodian.
And he says, you know, normally I'm quite a fearful guy, but with this museum, I'm like a lion.
Plus, in Iceland, glaciers literally weigh down the land, so when they melt because of climate change, that's a problem.
Iceland is definitely rising.
These stories today on The World. Glad you could be with us today. They call this day Black Friday. The sales, the crowds, all those ways retailers push us to spend, spend, spend. But this time of year, many people are also considering their holiday giving. And yes, there is a day for that, too. It's next Tuesday, and it's called Giving Tuesday. In a moment, we'll hear about how to be smart in your charitable giving. First, though, we want to spend a few minutes on one of the year's biggest stories that's also prompted many people to make donations. That's the arrival of hundreds of thousands of migrants and refugees in Western Europe this year. A focal point of this migration is the Greek island of Lesbos, an entry point for tens of thousands of non-Europeans. Reporter Jean Carstensen has spent the last couple of months on Lesbos, and we've been checking in periodically with her. Jean's just back in San Francisco now, so I asked her to share the most powerful impression she came home with.
I'd say the most powerful impression is one village, Skala Sikaminia. It's on the coast. 140 people. They themselves are the descendants of refugees, and now they find themselves with thousands of refugees pouring through the village. And it's just been very inspiring to meet those people and see how they have offered generosity. They open their little tavernas. They fishermen rescue people at night. They work with the Coast Guard, the NGO community, and to handle what really is a humanitarian crisis every day. And I find that village very inspiring.
This was not your first time spending several weeks on Lesbos. Remind us what drew you to the island in the first place. And is there kind of a before and after comparison that you think is worth mentioning?
Well, I went as a tourist. I fell in love with it. I loved swimming there. And I also was very compelled by the ancient history and did some research on the Greek god of Orpheus, who once had a oracle there on the island. And this experience has just made me fall in love with the place even more.
So this trip, these last 2 months, the longer you were there some realities about the refugees and what they were facing that really began to sink in over the weeks?
At first, when I met the boats on the coastline where they come in, I was so moved by these people. You feel every single one is on a sort of epic adventure, and I was awed by the spirit and the bravery of these people. And of course, as time went on, I also became sad and worried for what they were facing as they head north. There on Lesbos, there's been an incredible effort to at least greet the people on the shore, have some hot soup for them, have a bus there to take them to the next reception center. There's generally a smile. It's a moment of kindness, and it's a moment of relief for these people that they survived this terribly dangerous crossing. But of course, as we know, as they head north, not every border crossing will have that kind of warmth and welcome. And I started to really be worried about what these people were heading into.
Right. And very recently, what they've been facing is, they've kind of become unwitting actors in the fear that's settled in since the attacks on Paris on November 13th. I'm just curious, what have the refugees, what had the refugees been saying about the Paris attacks?
Yeah, I spent some time on the weekend before I left speaking with Syrian refugees, and they're very aware of what happened. I think for them, it doesn't change their need to go forward to get away from the war. They've seen also in the past, several mentioned to me that they're used to this when there is some kind of a terrorist incident in the world. Islam gets blamed for it, and they're used to this kind of situation. But these people told me, we have to leave, and we're hopeful that we can go to Europe and find a safe life there. And many of them tell me all we want is to work, and we want a safe place to raise our children.
Gene, are you going back to Lesbos? And what are the scenarios you consider when you think about the island's future?
Well, I hope the island will be able to handle this. I think there's a lot of concern that as Europe continues to close its borders and all the countries now are reconsidering the open door policy that they had, will we see refugees maybe trapped there? So far, that hasn't happened, but I think that could be a challenging scenario for the island. Will they continue to be generous if they have people living on their island permanently? And as for going back, I'm sure I'll go back. I hope to continue covering this story over the next several months.
Reporter Gene Carstensen in San Francisco, just back from the Greek island of Lesbos. Thanks for this, Gene, and thanks for your reporting.
Well, thank you, Marco.
It's hard to hear about the hardships facing migrants and refugees and not want to help in some way. Some of you might want to donate, but identifying a cause that is good and figuring out which charities use our donations in the best way possible, that can be complicated. Next week on The World, we're going to investigate this, and we'd like to know what you want to know. When you write a check to charity, what are your concerns? Reporter Amy Costello will be on hand to provide some answers. She hosts the Tiny Spark podcast, which looks into the business of doing good. Hi, Amy.
Hey, Marco.
You've been reporting on nonprofits and philanthropy for a few years now. What have you learned about effective giving?
Well, you know, that I think effective giving is really hard. It is difficult to know if a charity is having the impact that you think that it's having. It's hard to know where your donor dollars are going. And although it's often marketed as simple, I think it rarely is.
Yeah, so just one tip to whet our appetites. So what do you advise for vetting a good charity?
Well, the fact of the matter is there's so many good causes out there that it can feel a little overwhelming. And so a starting point can be to think about a cause that you personally care about and then do your research within that cause to find an effective charity. And I'll talk to you a little bit more next week about how a person can go about doing that.
And you've put together a whole series on effective giving, yeah?
I have, yeah. I spoke to a few smart people over recent weeks and asked them about their tips for effective giving. And not all of them agree with one another, but they all have thoughtful things to say.
We'll be talking with you next week all about that and spreading some of the knowledge that you've picked up. And in the meantime, we thought it'd be great to ask listeners about the questions they have about charitable giving. We hope you might be able to answer some of those.
I'd be happy to.
All right. So listeners, go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/PRI the world. You can leave your questions and Amy will be around to answer them. And then, Amy, you'll be back with me next week on Giving Tuesday on the World to share some answers and talk a little bit more about the tips you have for effective holiday giving. Sound good?
Looking forward to it.
Amy Costello there with the Tiny Spark podcast. Thank you very much for that. And listeners, you can write your questions or concerns about charities and holiday giving on our Facebook page. Again, that's facebook.com/PRI the world. And we'll aim to get you answers next week. This next story is one that some of you might have heard already. It aired on some stations on Friday, November 13th, the day of the Paris attacks. We pulled it, though, after we began to cover the aftermath of those horrific acts of terrorism. But we want to return to it now because it's a story we want all of you to hear. It's an update to another tragedy we covered back in February. You might recall it. A man barged into an apartment in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and shot three students to death. The students' names were Dia Barakat, his wife Yusor Abu Salah, and her sister Razan Abu Salah, all Muslim Americans. The case is still unfolding down in North Carolina, but this is not an update about that. It's a story about the dream Dia Barakat had and how his friends and family made it happen in the months after the tragedy. Jorge Valencia of station WUNC has that story.
Dia Barakat was a tall guy with a big smile and big ideas. He wanted to help people from his parents' native country, Syria. He was 23, a dental student, and he figured people fleeing Syria would need dental care. So he started planning. Here's his dad, Nami Barakat.
I have seen him with his laundry basket where he had these, toothpaste in it and, toothbrushes. I said, Dia, what are you doing?
Dia was trying to collect $20,000. That's how much money he would need to buy supplies and to take a group of volunteers to Turkey for a week. So he stood outside of mosques in North Carolina selling toothbrush kits, $5 each. He also made a video and uploaded it to the internet.
My name is Dia Barakat. I'm a dental student at UNC, and I need your help. Have you ever felt helpless about the situation in Syria and felt like you can't do anything about it? Well, this is your opportunity to help.
By the time Dia, his wife Yusor Abu Salha, and her sister Razan Abu Salha were killed, he had raised $16,000. Over the following month, strangers donated more than $500,000. So the friends and family of Dia, Yusser, and Razan decided they would carry out Dia's plan. Here's his brother, Faris.
I remember moving out his stuff from the apartment, and there was like a sheet of paper there about the trip, like all the things he wanted to do. Like there was something there about educating the patients about dental hygiene. Like there's all these, like, he had such a calculated and invested approach to this.
In late July, Dia's father, brother, and more than 40 American Muslim volunteers set out for Turkey. They included friends Dia encouraged to study dentistry and people from across the U.S. who'd never even met him. From Istanbul, the group flew to Hatay province. Then they drove 45 minutes to Reyhanli, a busy crossing point with Syria. Here's Faris.
Ahmed, you want to see Syria? That's the border. You see the barbed wire? That's Syria right there.
There's a small dental clinic here, just past the entrance of the Al Salam School. But across the playground, the volunteers set up a larger temporary clinic with 8 brand new dental chairs. They put up a poster with black and white drawings of Razan, Yusser, and Dia, and the words, "The Three Winners." The first day is chaotic. Sarah Araf is a dentist who traveled from Cleveland. Faris helps her as she's treating children.
Oh my gosh. Oh, there it is. She just pulled out a little girl's tooth. How old is she? 9? 7.
Soon, Faris takes the unofficial job of child whisperer. Many of the kids are too scared to get in the chair. Faris tries to calm them by explaining in Arabic what's going to happen. Though Sarah Araf doesn't entirely agree with his approach.
Faris decided to use the word needle on a kid and he freaked him out.
I told him how it is. He was afraid of needles. I told him, bear with me on the needle.
I told him to call it sleepy juice. And I'm pretty sure...
I don't know how to translate sleepy juice into Arabic.
I'm pretty sure if you said sleepy juice, things would have gone a lot better than they did.
Well, anyways, it worked out. And I think we took his phobia for needles and fixed it.
Most of the patients here are children, and many have witnessed violence. One boy was struck with shrapnel on a cheekbone and can no longer close his right eye. Heaven, heaven, heaven. Our home is really heaven. On the fourth day, a few dozen high school students serenade the volunteers with songs about homes and Hama, cities that largely have been destroyed by the war. Faris covers his eyes. He thinks about the months since his brother's death. He quit his job managing a courier company in North Carolina, and he's helping build a Muslim community center in Raleigh named after Dia, which in Arabic means light.
I think what I'm doing through the Lighthouse Project is what I'm meant to do in a sense and what I want to do. And this is helping me explore everything that I've ever wanted to explore. You know, at the end of the day, do the work that earns me personal salvation. And that's where I'll see my brother and the prophets, all of them.
So far, Dia's Project Refugee Smiles has helped more than 700 Syrian refugees. And his family says the donations will fund dental care and other refugee relief for years to come. Yet Faris says he's caught himself wishing he could give back the great things that have happened since the shooting, if it meant he could have Dia, Yusser, and Razan back. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
What a great story. Jorge reported from southern Turkey with support from the International Center for Journalists, sponsored by the Ford Foundation. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Pope Francis is on a pilgrimage in Africa, which he called the Continent of Hope today. Francis traveled from Kenya to Uganda, and over the weekend, he's expected to visit the Central African Republic. Hope is something that's been in short supply for the CAR in recent years. My BBC colleague Tim Hewell joins me now to talk about what Pope Francis is stepping into in the CAR. You've done some reporting in the Central African Republic last year, Tim, when things were kind of hot there. Pope Francis will be in the capital, Bangui. What's he likely to find there?
Well, I think it remains a very dangerous place, a place certainly where, for example, it's too dangerous for him to go outside the capital, Bangui. It's really too dangerous for almost anybody, you know, who's being on the safe side to travel outside except by plane. The roads are controlled by armed militia from two different sides. You know, very briefly, this was not originally a religious conflict. Everybody thinks about this now as something where Christians are killing Muslims and Muslims are killing Christians. It started 2 years ago when a militia from the north of the country gradually fought its way through the country to the capital, Bangui. It was a militia called the Seleka. It was principally a Muslim militia, and it committed really terrible atrocities against the people it found along the way, most of those people Christian. And it's a result of that that this other militia, Christian militia called the Anti-Balaka, was formed. But originally it certainly wasn't about religion, and many people believe even now that it's politicians on both sides for various reasons that want to keep the whole religious thing alive, when really that's not what it's about.
Right. So if it does seem now that it's Muslim versus Christian, and that famous story of the priest in CAR who risked his life sheltering a large group of Muslims in his church, I mean, who will Pope Francis be talking to, and what is he going to try and do once he gets there?
Well, he's doing one extraordinary thing within the confines of the capital, Bangui. He is going to one of the most dangerous places he could be going to. He's going to the only remaining Muslim enclave in the capital. And basically, of course, there's been a massive, most people call it ethnic or religious cleansing of Muslims now from Central African Republic, from all the towns they were in. Most of them have fled over the borders, either into Chad to the north or Cameroon to the west. But the tiny group left really besieged in the capital. The only remaining place where they are around a particular mosque, which I visited last year, surrounded again by a cordon of international peacekeepers. As I understand it, the plan is for the Pope to go through that cordon and be greeted by the imam of these besieged Muslims in this mosque. So that's quite a brave thing to do. But of course, that shows also, you know, that the imam of that mosque is delighted to meet the Pope. And so on both sides, religious leaders have been trying to calm this down. And as you say, on the other side, extraordinary heroism by really quite a number of Catholic priests, not only one, but many, including several I met, who, as the Muslims were being chased and threatened with death by these supposedly Christian militias, the Catholic priests themselves took the Muslims into the churches and protected them there. And some are still there even now, even a year on, that there are Muslims living, you know, basically just in sleeping bags on mattresses on the floors of churches.
My colleague Tim Huell speaking with me from the BBC in London. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
For our next story, I want to tell you about a mysterious storage vault. It's deep within a building in Iran's capital, Tehran, and until recently, most people didn't even know it was there and what was in it. The World's Shirin Jafari explains.
Okay, so if you're thinking that this mystery has something to do with Iran's nuclear program, sorry. This isn't about some unknown enrichment facility that I just discovered. It's about a somewhat drab concrete building in central Tehran. Actually, it's a museum.
So you walk in and there's a foyer, and in the foyer is kind of a spiraling walkway that goes downward, literally from the street. So you're headed down into the ground.
That's Peter Waldman, a reporter with Bloomberg News. Recently, he visited that museum basement in Tehran, and he was surprised by what he saw.
I was just blown away that you could have Monet and Matisse and Toulouse-Lautrec and all of these artists and Warhol sitting in a vault beneath a museum thousands of miles away from any European or American capital, and no one really knows.
Back in the 1970s, Iran's queen, Farah Pahlavi, went on a shopping spree. An art lover, she wanted to build a museum in Tehran that would house some of the best modern and pop art in the world. She headed to Europe and the US in search of those pieces. The museum was built, the artwork was purchased and brought to Tehran. But in 1979, just before the art went on display, the Islamic Revolution happened. And Ayatollah Khomeini was in charge.
His people were not crazy about Western culture, and the concern for the art was that it might be dispersed, it might be sold, it might be destroyed.
The fact that some of the paintings contained nude figures didn't help. Thankfully, though, there was this one man, the hero of the story, you might say. Firuz Shahbazi Moghaddam was hired as a driver and later worked as a handyman for the museum. In the chaos of the revolutionary days, he moved the paintings into the vault and made sure they were kept safe. There was that time, for example, when some militiamen paid him a visit.
Shahbazi took the keys to the vault himself and showed the militiamen that nothing was going on in the basement, in the vault, and he became the protector of the art. And to this day, he calls himself a lion in terms of his protection of the museum and the vault and the artworks. And he says, you know, normally I'm quite a fearful guy. And he actually cried when he told me this story. And he said, but with this museum, I'm like a lion.
Shahbazi's work paid off. The more than 1,500 pieces of art survived the revolution and 36 years of being kept in storage. Some of the pieces have been shown publicly in the past, but some have never left the basement. That could change soon. Just this week, a new exhibit kicked off at the museum to showcase some of the pieces. Germano Cerlant was one of the curators. He's a well-known Italian art historian. I reached him a few hours after he got back to Italy from Tehran, where he attended the opening.
It was totally packed, the opening, mostly young people, curious and, you know, taking notes. And, you know, it was incredible for me.
Cerlant says now with the somewhat moderate government in power in Tehran, there's once again an opening to show Western art in museums. He says just the fact that a Westerner was invited to curate the exhibit is telling. And the recent nuclear deal between Iran and world powers has raised the possibility of more cultural exchanges. There's even talk that some of these paintings could be heading to Berlin, Rome, and Washington as soon as next year. But of course, when you're talking about moving an estimated $5 to $10 billion worth of art, there's bound to be some challenges.
There is no insurance coverage on this. It's impossible. Not the value in the museum, but between the two museums, let's say, the traveling, the street.
So until these issues are resolved, the pieces can only be seen up close in Tehran, under the watchful eyes of Shahbazi the Lion. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. France vows never to change the way of life that gunmen targeted on November 13th. And for one French food expert, that includes the thing you eat with nearly every meal.
He felt bread was the way to fight back because bread is about humanity. It's about nurturing. It's about people coming together.
That story ahead here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Next week, the UN Climate Change Summit opens in Paris, and there is a lot at stake. More than 190 nations are sending representatives to the summit. They'll be trying to reach a new global agreement to combat climate change. We all know what climate change can do to the planet, right? Sea levels rise, more droughts and floods. We're seeing some of that already. But what we're only starting to learn is that in some parts of the world, climate change can actually cause the Earth itself to behave differently. The World's Ari Daniel recently traveled to Iceland, a geologically volatile place, to learn about the possible effects of climate change there.
The first thing to know is that Iceland is changing. You can actually see it happening. Sven-Bjørn Stenthorsen, a muscular guy in his 40s, grew up hiking on glaciers here.
First trips to the glacier, I was like 14, 15 years old. It was easy to find a spot on the glacier to see only white. You could not see the mountain in the north, and you thought you were alone in the world.
But now, when Stenthorsen goes to those same places and looks out, he sees mountains and bare land poking through the white.
So it's melting fast.
And he's hardly the only one that's noticed. Freystein Sigmundsson is a geophysicist at the University of Iceland.
I can see the opening of new landscape.
And it turns out that melting isn't just affecting Iceland's surface. It's also affecting what's happening underground. In fact, it could lead to more volcanic eruptions. No joke. But to explain, we need to go on a road trip in the Icelandic highlands over a landscape of barren rolling hills of volcanic rock and peaks the colors of dark chocolate and butterscotch.
Okay, so we are in a big jeep, driving on a bumpy road.
We have something we call super jeeps, jeeps with modified tires so they can drive across rivers and across snow.
We're passing between a couple of the biggest glaciers in Iceland, Vatnajökull and Hofsjökull. They sprawl in the distance on either side of us.
Okay, we've arrived.
When the jeep stops, we set out by foot up a shallow hillside.
We have arrived at the site we want to measure.
It looks like an ordinary slab of brown rock, but mounted to that rock is a metal button the size of a coin.
So now we just need to get this over the site.
Sigmundsson and his colleague maneuver a big tripod into position over the button below. They secure the whole setup with large rocks to keep it from being pushed around by crazy fast winds and heavy rains. And on top of the tripod, Sigmundsson perches a special kind of GPS sensor that measures not just latitude and longitude, but vertical position as well. Because you see, the ground here is pushing up.
Iceland is definitely rising.
It's called post-glacial rebound. Think of how heavy all that ice is pushing down on the Earth. As the warming atmosphere causes the glaciers to melt, that pressure eases and the ground rises up. Sigmundsson's out here to measure that change.
The rate of growth is comparable to the growth of your fingernails, about 2-3 centimeters per year if you would not cut them.
The reason for the quick pace isn't just the receding glaciers. The land here is also being pushed up by the volcanic hotspot below the Atlantic that originally formed Iceland. In other words, the country's parked above a churning furnace.
So it's a melting pot down there. I think of it as the fire heart of Iceland.
For as long as people have been here, glaciers have kept that fire heart reasonably contained. But Sigmundsson's concerned that the melting ice may trigger a volatile cascade.
The pressure change is enough to generate extra amount of magma inside the Earth. So we can say global warming is not only causing melting of the ice caps, it is causing melting of the solid Earth here under Iceland.
And here's what that could mean. More volcanic activity. Volcanoes erupting sooner than they would have otherwise, or more powerfully. It could even mean more eruptions of volcanoes still partially covered with ice.
If it is a subglacial eruption, it melts massive amounts of ice rapidly and generates floods.
Now, no one's proven yet that this chain reaction from less ice to more volcanoes actually happens. It's also possible that disappearing glaciers could mean a delay for some volcanic activity. All of that is what Sigmundsson and his team are here to figure out.
We can say Iceland is like a laboratory. Of the more than 1,000 volcanoes on Earth, many of them are ice-covered.
So what's learned here will shape our understanding elsewhere. Part of a growing field of research into the geological impacts of climate change. For Sigmundsson's team, the work starts by collecting data from each GPS station for a couple of days before moving them to new locations. That's what he and Sven-Bjørn Stenthorsen are doing now in a cold rain, on land that, as Stenthorsen has come to understand, is undeniably alive.
Not just sitting there, moved and it's breathing.
It's breathing, he says. And when Iceland exhales, it may move heaven and earth. For The World, I'm Ari Daniel near Vatnajökull Glacier, Iceland.
Ari's reporting in Iceland was supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Earlier on The World, we were talking about the refugees escaping Syria and Iraq. For many of us, it's been really difficult to watch this unfolding. I know it has been for me. For one thing, the sheer number of people is numbing. So are the constant stories of children in trouble. Children dying en route to Europe. Children who lose their parents and then end up alone and scared.
It's unbelievable. It's terrible. That's why I can't see movies with kids in it. Kids have troubles. Because I start crying and I can't stop crying. You had no power, so you suffer through it.
Miriam Geismar, now 84, knows what it's like to be a powerless child and to have to suffer through that as a Jewish girl in World War II Holland. I met Miriam and her daughter Daphne Geismar in New Haven, Connecticut, where they live. 70 years ago, Miriam's own story of suffering ended when the war ended. For nearly 3 years, though, she didn't see her parents, didn't know where they were, and didn't know if she would see them again or what the future held. Curiously, before Miriam was separated from her parents during the war, she was seeing into the future in her dreams. She had one recurring nightmare that a German shepherd, a dog once associated with the Nazis, was chasing her. She also had another recurring nightmare. It went like this.
We were standing somewhere and was just everybody looking at a clock. And they said, well, if the clock stops at 12, that's when the war will start. And we were all looking and it stopped.
On August 19th, 1942, the day of her parents' anniversary, Miriam came home from school.
I went to my bedroom and I saw my parents coming and said, we have to tell you something. And then they said, it's got too dangerous. The Germans are somehow going to find us. We have to find hiding places, and we found one for you.
At the age of 11, Miriam got on her push scooter and left her parents and her two sisters. The first family she stayed with, she knew.
I had braids. Mm-hmm. And before I was sent to this first family on my scooter. They changed the name from Miriam to Manya because Miriam was so obviously Jewish. And they cut off my braids because I had long braids, because that supposedly made me look more Jewish.
Later, she was transferred to another home, people she did not know, and then a third where she stayed for the rest of the war. At the third hiding place, the full extent of the fear she and the people hiding her were feeling was undeniable. Home number three belonged to Tante Nell van Vliet, a single mother. She had a daughter of her own and was already harboring one Jewish boy. Tante Nell wanted to help. She also needed some income, and hiding Jewish kids would bring her some money. But near the end of the war, food was so scarce that you needed a relative fortune just to feed a small family. Tante Nell resorted to things like mashed tulip bulbs mixed with flour to keep herself and her charges from starving. As scary and untethered as daily life was for Miriam, it all became kind of routine.
And we slept in a hiding place at night under the kitchen floor.
So there's a trap door in the floor.
A trap door in the floor. We had a potty, so just in case we had to go to the bathroom, we were asked to keep it in as much as possible.
There were some books in Dutch that Miriam read over and over, Winnie the Pooh, Uncle Tom's Cabin. Occasionally a teacher would slip by the house and go over reading, writing, and arithmetic with the kids. Strange knocks on the door, though, were rarely answered. Now, Miriam knew her parents were still alive, but didn't know where they were. Her parents had sorted out hiding places for their three girls, but they struggled to find shelter.
They couldn't find an address. They ran house to house, like begging. They knew somebody, ended up at his sister's house, who was married to a non-Jew, whose sister was a teacher, and so was her husband. So they didn't have any children, and they went there to beg if they could stay there for a while. And his sister said no.
Before the war, Miriam's father had held an important job as a chief pharmacist of the city of Rotterdam. He knew people, but not even his own sister would risk hiding her sibling. There was another option.
There was the pharmacist in Rotterdam who helped my father with medication, also found out about the church.
Yeah, Miriam's parents ended up being sheltered in a church. That pharmacist introduced them to the minister of the Breplein Church in Rotterdam, and he agreed to take them in. The church is still there today with a plaque out front explaining its role hiding Jews during the war. Where physically in the church were they?
In the roof.
In the roof of the church?
Yes, yeah. You tell them.
Miriam Geismar is talking to her daughter Daphne there. Yeah. Daphne has become kind of the keeper of her parents' and grandparents' history. She knows their story well.
The minister went to the caretaker of the church and said, I would like you to help me create a place for this Jewish couple to hide. The caretaker said, well, I never told you this, but there's another Jewish family that's been hiding in the attic for a year already. So they made a second hiding place. So they were mirror images on either side of the organ pipes.
Two and a half years living behind a church organ, that's bound to have some consequences.
That's why my parents hated organ music after the war.
They hated organ music, but they survived. On a personal level, though, the conditions they found in that church crawl space completely reordered their lives.
They had to lay in bed the whole daytime because people who come and visit in the church could hear them walking if they would be. And they slept sometimes for 24 hours, they were in that bed. Well, if you have a good marriage, it goes maybe. If you have an in-between marriage, it's not the best wedding. And if you have a terrible marriage, it's murder.
How was their marriage?
Good. My mother was very vivacious and my father was very philosophical. He kept her happy with sleeping pills. And after the war, she was addicted to them. She was like somebody who was drunk all the time.
The sleeping pills kept Miriam's restless mother quiet in their hiding place. Silence was crucial. And months before the end of the war, there was one close call where noise would have given Miriam's parents away to the Nazis.
They were looking for weapons. And somebody had told them there was weapons in there, hidden in the church.
Here's Miriam's daughter, Daphne Geismar, again, picking up the story.
My grandmother was asleep in the attic, and right below the attic was another little room. It was still behind the organ pipe, so nobody came up there, and that's often where my grandfather would go to read. So he was there, and he suddenly heard the other family hiding on the other side of the organ pipes. And they were saying, you know, quick, quick, get into your hiding place. So my grandfather looked out into the nave of the church, and he saw the Dutch Nazi police searching the church. So he knew he had to get into his space very quickly and without anybody hearing him. So there was a ladder that he crawled up into the space, and then he would throw the ladder up and catch it and throw it and catch it because he couldn't pull it up because it would grate along the side and make too much noise. So he got the ladder up and closed the trap door and was very happy to see that my grandmother was sleeping, so she would be quiet. And then the SS did come up to the space right below where he was. And as they were there, he saw this spoon from lunch teetering on the edge of the stones. And it could have fallen or not, and it happened not to have fallen. And so he could hear them searching around in the pipes of the organ, and then they left.
Just one of many incredible stories that emerge from war. The stories of the ones who survived, by sheer luck in many cases. Many Jews thought that all they had to do was hide, not make noise, and things would be fine once the war was over. Miriam's family did.
We just said that we'd just be quiet, we'll survive, and we'll all come nicely together. And somehow it worked for me, but it didn't work for many, many other people. Many more.
Including dozens of her own families, grandparents, aunts, uncles, and cousins. So why do we tell these stories? I asked Miriam Geismar that, and her answer, basically, because stories are the only thing the survivors have.
That's the only thing you can fight it back. What is there else to do? You feel you have to do something, so you tell the story, maybe. Even if it helps one person, it's worth it, especially if you're a child.
And so Miriam told Daphne, her daughter, and Daphne tells her daughter, and they told me, and I tell you. When the war ended, Miriam and her two sisters were brought out of their hiding places and taken to the church in Rotterdam. Her family did come back nicely together. Sheer luck. But somewhere in that luck lies some hope. Miriam Geismar's parents couldn't tolerate organ music again, but her father never lost his taste for Mozart. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. The nation of France took a long pause today.
Thomas Ayad, 32 ans.
Guillaume Barreau de Cherf.
The names of all 130 victims of the Paris attacks were read out at a ceremony at the Invalides National Monument in the French capital. In the 2 weeks since those attacks, many in France have developed a sense of common purpose, of solidarity. People around the world are expressing it too. On social media, from Lebanon to Pakistan, one image in particular stands out. I'm sure you've seen it. It's a mashup of the peace symbol and the Eiffel Tower. It's the creation of French illustrator Jean Julien, who was abroad on vacation when he heard the news.
The first thing that I could think of was take a piece of paper and draw the first thing that sprung to my mind, which would be a sign of peace and solidarity towards Paris. So I just merged two symbols, but it was extremely spontaneous and instinctive. It wasn't a calculated image like I would do as an illustrator in my work. It was just a very genuine reaction.
In its short life, Julien's symbol has outgrown its French roots. People in other troubled parts of the world are using it to denounce violence.
I think that's why maybe it resonated, even though the sign is sort of depicting a French symbol. For me, it was all very contextual. But I think the sentiment of peace, as corny as it sounded, is universal and very much something that we're all tired of. Wherever you're in the world, you're tired of hearing these things.
Jean Julien's piece for Paris symbol has also appeared in an unlikely place, but still full of meaning to Parisians and visitors to their city. It's on something that you'll find at pretty much every French meal, bread. Sam Fromarts knows more than most Americans about good French bread. He's the author of In Search of the Perfect Loaf, A Home Baker's Odyssey. I'll let the world's Clark Boyd take it from here.
When I first spoke with Sam Fromarts more than a year ago, his book on bread was just out in hardback. I met him in the kitchen of his Washington, D.C. home, and he was busy doing what he really loves, making baguettes.
My mother's Japanese-American. My father is Jewish. My grandparents immigrated from the Ukraine. I grew up with this rich relationship with starches because my mom would make rice and my dad would always have to have bread on the table.
Fromarts isn't just an avid home baker. He's a journalist. But he says he never wanted to write about bread baking. It was his hobby, his way of blowing off steam. Then the economy went south a few years back, his regular sources of freelance work dried up, and he was on the hunt for stories to sell. Then he thought, I've always wanted to go to Paris and learn how to make the perfect baguette.
For the most part, trying to make a baguette starting out is like trying to sit down at the piano and play a Beethoven sonata. It's just not going to come out like a Beethoven sonata.
A travel magazine bit on his American baguette baker in Paris idea, and 3 weeks later, he woke up before dawn in a Paris hotel.
I dressed in my baker's whites, and I went downstairs to the lobby of the hotel, and the night clerk was just shocked to see me. And he was wondering what I was doing, and I mumbled something about a boulangerie and went out into the night air. The streets were empty, but as soon as I got to the bakery, there was an open door, and I could smell the baking bread coming out, and the young baker, Tomas, was there working away, and, you know, I got right into it. Tomas didn't speak a word of English, and my French is kind of rudimentary. I can order a meal, I could say a few words, but, you know, it's not much more than that. But the thing about baking is it's so tactile, it's so informed by the senses that you learn a lot more just by doing it and feeling the dough. And I got so much out of the experience without being fluent in the language itself. I became fluent in the language of bread.
So Fromarts' trip to Paris was successful. He decided to visit other top bakers in Europe, across the U.S. He learned all about ingredients and techniques, and that's how Fromarts' book came to be. Now, normally, I just wrap this up now back in Fromarts' D.C. kitchen. You know, perfectly timed to coincide with his baguettes being done.
And then I use a razor blade to cut the loaves.
Et voila!
Except that I never wrote that story a year ago. Excuses? Yeah, I got a million of them. The truth is that after the Paris attacks a couple of weeks ago, I remembered Fromarts and his book, and I really wanted to ask him how his baking friends in Paris were dealing with it all.
I would say within 24 hours of the attacks, I immediately began to see all these pictures on Facebook of people posting breads with the symbol of the Eiffel Tower in the, you know, in the iconic peace symbol.
Fromarts told me that the man who edited the Encyclopedia of Bread in France, not a small book, had weighed in.
He expressed a lot of anger in his post, but he also said, you know, he felt bread was the way to fight back because bread is about humanity. It's about nurturing. It's about people coming together. You know, bread really is this iconic cultural symbol. And the other important point that he made was that it belongs to everyone.
And he means everyone.
Because if you go into the baking rooms in Paris, you see a lot of North Africans, Moroccans, Algerians, and they're world-class bakers. And, you know, it's a craft that knows no boundaries. I think what these bakers have been expressing is that the bread, you know, unites them in a fundamental way against, you know, all that these terrorist attacks represent.
Sam Fromart says he has no doubt Paris will make it through this crisis, and there will be plenty of excellent baguettes to help. The city's bakers, he says, aren't going anywhere. For The World, I'm Clark Boyd.
Je suis le dauphin de la place Dauphine et la place Blanche à mauvaise mine.
Here's an iconic song about the Paris many of us know and love from singer Jacques Dutronc.
Il est 5 heures, Paris.
Il est 5 heures, Paris s'éveille. It is 5 a.m., Paris wake up. Jacques Dutronc sings to us of Paris early in the morning. Milk trucks, hey, it was the 60s, street sweepers with their brooms. If you've ever arrived there on an overnight flight, you know what Dutronc is talking about. And as Clark just reminded us, the bakers are making their bread.
Les banlieusards sont dans les gares, à la Villette, on tranche le lard. Paris by night regagne l'écart, les boulangers font des bâtards. Il est 5 heures, Paris.
On this day after Thanksgiving, some thanks to our tech support people here at WGBH. These guys are the ones who make sure that our show gets from our studio to your radio or any of the devices, phone, iPod, tablet, that you listen to the world on. Miles Smith, John Frank, and Dennis Correa, you guys are the champs, as Jackson Brown once said about his roadies. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH. Here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Have a great weekend, and we're back with you on Monday.
Les journaux sont imprimés, les ouvriers sont déprimés. Les gens se lèvent, ils sont brimés, c'est l'heure où je vais me coucher.
PRI, Public Radio International.